Good morning, everybody. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Ellie Miller, and I am an attorney. I am the president of the Axall board at this time, and I am a former public defender in Los Angeles County. Worked as a public defender for more than 19 years, handled multiple types of cases, represented somebody in a death penalty case where there was a penalty phase. And when I left the public defender's office, I started doing post-conviction work, starting off with Homeboy Industries, which is a gang rehabilitation center in Los Angeles, started by Father Boyle, Father Greg Boyle, who's a Jesuit priest. And subsequently, I went on to other nonprofits in LA. I started a post-conviction clinic at Loyola Law School. I retired from that about a year and a half ago, and presently I teach sentencing law there. So my expertise is criminal law and post-conviction work, and I am happy to lead the meeting today and welcome everybody. And I will start off by handing over the meeting to Marty, who's going to talk about the emotional support groups.
Thank you, Ellie. So we are so familiar with traumas inflicted by the registry, not only upon ourselves, but on our loved ones too. Bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends, difficulty finding work and housing. We've just had an example not too long ago. Life can be rough for every person affected. That's why Axall runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will take place on Thursday and next Saturday. These special groups are not just for registrants. Loved ones and supporters are welcome too. Every Thursday evening, Axall board member Sherry Moreno runs group beginning at 6:30 Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist Alex Gittinger leads the Saturday afternoon meeting. The time, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. At every meeting, we have a supportive community here to help each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant. No trolls, no bullies, no law enforcement, no haters at our meeting. No parole, no probation, nothing. We don't let them in. How can you participate in these wonderful groups? Please see the information that I will post in the chat moments after I finish this announcement. If you don't have the access to the chat because you're on the phone, click on the emotional support group link the next time you visit the Axall website homepage. And I promise, after participating in the Axall emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. One final anecdote, and this is my personal editorial opinion, does not represent the view of any organization, and I will start with a quote from Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Quote, "I am a very strong believer in listening and learning from others," unquote. In the Axall Emotional Support Groups, you will learn a lot by listening to us, and we will equally learn a lot by listening to you. And together, we will make strides. Back to you, Ellie.
Thank you, Marty. And so I often get emails or phone calls from individuals new to the registry. And the first thing I tell them is that you got to check out the emotional support group that Axall runs. And a lot of times people feel lost when they're initially placed on the registry. And the emotional support group will provide that. And Axall will provide support in other ways. And that leads me to talk about the Axall in-person conference that we're having October 2nd and 3rd in Los Angeles at the Embassy Suites, which is near the Los Angeles airport. So for anybody who's coming from out of town, the Los Angeles airport is right next to the Embassy Suites, so it's somewhat convenient. And the fee right now, the early bird fee is $150, and registration is open. I just registered myself yesterday. And after a certain date, the fee will go up to $185, but that includes coffee and tea in the morning and lunch on both days. So right now, most of the conference agenda is set up. There's going to be panels on the registry, how to terminate registration, how to navigate probation and parole. So there's going to be a lot of information packed into 2 days at the Embassy Suites. So anybody who's interested, wants to learn more, go to the website and sign up. And we hope we see you there. Any questions about the in-person conference? Okay. I believe believe on the website, the location may not be divulged, so we don't have any trolls who come and try to sabotage the meeting. But it's at a hotel close to the airport. And no, somebody asked the question if there's dinner. No, you're on your own for dinner. We provide the lunch, and the conference ends about 4 or 5 in the evening every day.
They were just released that we're starting to say the name, so I'll put it in there. The Embassy Suites, put it on there. But all the
Okay.
information is on the page. And please consider signing up for hotels, and also so you get the low rates and then the room layout that you want. There are two links on there, one to sign up and one to get a hotel link.
Okay. Thank you, Roger. So let's talk about international travel. And I'm not Janice, and Janice knows about the countries that prohibit people on the registry. But one thing that I do want to discuss is the passport identifiers for people who register. And it is a federal law. And basically, it says that the Secretary of State shall not issue a passport. And they use the term covered sex offender. I prefer registrant, unless the passport contains a unique identifier and may revoke a passport previously issued without an identifier of a registrant. So anybody who had been able to terminate their registration, if they have a passport with a unique identifier, they can turn it in and get one that does not have a unique identifier. When they say the person is a registrant, what they mean is that an individual who has been convicted of a registrable offense or an individual required to register under the program of any jurisdiction or on the basis of an offense against a minor. So that is one part of the issue in regard to traveling internationally, is having that identifier on the passport. And I think Janice is very good at talking about the countries. She recalls a person who was on the plane with his wife visiting a country, and before the plane took off, he was asked to leave because the country was not going to admit him. So those are the pitfalls of international travel, not only the Schengen countries, but also having that unique identifier on the passport. So are there any comments about the passport? David. Oh, hi, David. You're here. You have to unmute. David, one of our board members, is present and he needs to unmute.
Okay, I think you can
There you
hear me
go.
now.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay, Allie?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to provide some information on travel if I can, and if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them as best I'm able to. I myself in the past had a marked passport with one of the IML unique identifiers on it. I traveled back and forth from the US to Europe quite frequently, as I still do. I now have an unmarked passport because I was able to be removed from the two registries I was on. I can tell you this, I had no problems at all traveling with a marked passport entering into the European Schengen countries. And in fact, the only time that a border control officer even looked at the unique identifier, he looked at it, he apparently read it, just shrugged his shoulders and said, "Welcome to France, enjoy your vacation." So no problems at all there. I should note that I stay in VRBO rentals, which are like Airbnbs in Europe. I do not stay in hotels. When you stay in a hotel, most places they will take your passport and at very least make a photocopy of the front page of it. But many of them, from what I understand, will simply hold your passport like in their hotel safe while you're staying with them. So I've never stayed in a hotel, so no one has ever actually held on to my passport or looked through it with great care. I use VRBOs because they are accessible to people like me who, even though I was registered, I could use the VRBO app to make rentals with virtually no problem. There was one person who kept denying my request to rent rent their apartment. And I don't know, I think she might have just had issues with a male renting her apartment. In any case, no one said anything to me, and I was never excluded from using that the VRBO platform to make rentals. Not sure what else I can tell you. If people have questions, I will be more than happy to answer them. What about traveling on a cruise? I saw that someone asked about traveling on a cruise. I have never taken a cruise since ever being registered. So I honestly have no idea, but you might want to look through the international travel section on the website, because there are quite a number of mentions of cruises. And if you scroll through, you will find that some cruise lines are named that will exclude you.
All right. Thanks, David, for that information. Sure. Norm, you have your hand up?
Yes, ma'am. I have a question and an answer. It is on the first page right here. My picture is here under my fingers, and it says it right there. Unfortunately, it's, you know, against a minor, and if you've been in the proactive stings as I have, there is no minor, which is, you know, deliberately misleading, of course. The laws never say fake minor. But here's my question. So I'm a tier one, and I have some people in the Philippines I would like to visit. Philippines is a little weird on some of that. When I research it, it almost seems like it comes down to what the border guard feels at the moment as you're coming through. Because if you're a lower tier and you can show documentation that there was no actual child, I've heard so many different things, including from attorneys. So I'm not quite sure what to believe. And if I wonder if anybody has experience or anecdotes or anything they've heard on that.
I can give you an answer.
Yes.
From what I know, you're probably going to have trouble getting into the Philippines. The people I know who have been successful doing so, who are registered, have typically traveled from other second party countries. Mm-hmm. So they've flown to Ecuador and then flown to the Philippines, or, you know, flown to Germany and then flown on to Tokyo or whatever. Okay, so that's one thing. I don't know about that. I don't have firsthand experience, so I can't inform you about that. I can inform you that I was once scheduled to make it was either a layover or a plane change in the United Kingdom. And like you, I went through all the procedures and contacted all the right people until finally the answer I got from the head of the Garda, the security in Ireland, simply stated that, you know, it shouldn't be a problem, but it is always up to the individual border control officer as to whether they allow you in the country or deny you entry. So apparently this is quite a common thing. And apparently, he mentioned there was no appeal to it. If the border control officer says no, the answer is no. So maybe it works that way in every country. I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard similar things. I mean, I have, you know, I have about 8 years left on this miserable registry. I mean, there is a possibility of going to a place like Colorado. You might be aware Colorado has a law that says if you've been on the thing for 10 years, even if you come in from the outside in another state, you can petition after 10 years. And of course, after you meet the residency requirement of the particular state and petition to get off of it. I attempted to contact people in Colorado who might be able to help me, attorneys. Nobody wants to stick their neck. It was my interpretation. Nobody knew nothing about nothing. But, you know, the law seems very clearly written. And you know how cautious attorneys can be, Ellie. So nobody wanted to take on anything. I have a feeling if I went to and I may go visit for vacation, I might even be able to represent myself in court. And, you know, the worst they could say is no, I suppose. But, you know, it is, they are aware increasingly, and then I'll pipe down here, that people are, you know, very fed up with this unfair registry, and they're going elsewhere. You know, they're finding ways to get around it.
One thing I want to add is that if you're in Virginia now and you go to Colorado, you establish residency and you petition to be removed off the registry, Colorado may grant it for that state, but not necessarily for Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think one of the issues is, that, you know, by moving from one state to another, because I was doing some research yesterday and I saw comments that Colorado was fairly kind to registrants, but I don't think the termination of registration in Colorado will do anything for you in Virginia.
There are horror stories about that, going back to your state or going to another state, and you know they want to fall back on the money or the power or both.
Because I remember receiving an email from somebody who registered in California and then moved to Maryland, and his particular offense did not require registration in Maryland, and he wanted to terminate California, but I think he was in a tier that required the 10-year registration, and he didn't have it because he moved. And so that it's kind of like a catch-22. You know, he doesn't have to register in his new state, but yet he doesn't have the requisite time to terminate from California. So, you know, there's kind of nuances, you know, with registration for each state. And I was looking up yesterday, and I found that two states have no vehicle to terminate registration. And then for the life of me, I couldn't find out which two states those are. But most states do have a way to terminate registration. And Marina, we kind of made a left turn. So bear with us, but we could go back to international travel. Rick, you had your hand up.
Thank you. Are you? I went to Manila Airport from San Francisco, and I was courteously told that I would not be allowed into the country. I stayed in their little jail hotel, which was very nice and complete with a guard, and promptly returned back to the United States. Everything was done very courteously, but I was not allowed to come in with my endorsement. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Marina, you have your hand up.
Yes. Talking about international travel, before Arizona required the identifier to be, they weren't following the international Megan's Law. We didn't know that. We didn't even know about international Megan's Law. But we had traveled internationally and never had any problems at all. And then Mike started getting pulled aside for secondary when we returned to the United States. And so then I Googled why that happened. I found about international Megan's Law, and he was supposed to have a unique passport. His passport was going to expire. He sent it in for a new passport, not knowing he was supposed to self-proclaim with a statement that he was a covered offender. So he got the new passport without it. We thought, oh, good, he's clear. We even contacted, when we were going on a cruise to Alaska, we contacted his reporting officer, and he said, oh, no, you're not on any federal list. I don't need any information from you. Went on the cruise that made a stop in Vancouver to Alaska. He got pulled off by the Canadian border controls and said, don't ever come back again. And so then when we were going on another cruise, we contacted a reporting officer. He says, oh yeah, there is, we have to do that now. We have to have your information. 3 weeks before this transatlantic cruise out of Florida, he got an email that his passport was revoked. So we were scrambling because he had given his 21-day notice. And so he got a new passport and submitted the information at the last minute. Since that identifier, we were nervous. We had plan B to meet our traveling companions by just flying to Europe direct because we're airline retirees. And but since that identifier's been on his passport, he has not been pulled aside for secondary screening. Before that, we anticipated it. And so I would always carry his phone and his backpack and go out so he would have nothing on him. But the last time the last time we came through, the guy just said, oh, wow, this is old. I can't clear the flag. Someone else will. And well, it was just a couple minutes, I think, they cleared the flag and he was gone. We have gone on two transatlantic cruises without any problems, and maybe because there's no kids on cruises. He wasn't also at that time not on a public website. Arizona changed that law 2 years ago that all level one with DCAC are now on a public website. So we have not tried to cruise since that time. However, we did a European river cruise. We flew over, and we know to only go to the Schengen countries. We flew over to Germany. We took a train to Vienna. When I got on the cruise ship, they asked for a passport. I handed them mine. That was sufficient. They checked us in. They never even looked at his. Airbnb, you have to be careful because technically registrants are not allowed to stay or book an Airbnb. I always book Airbnb in my name. Rarely do we stay in hotels unless it's just for one night. But that's our experience. River cruises are cool. You can do those.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Marina. David, you have to unmute.
Sorry. There we go. Thanks, Roger. One of the states you might be thinking of, Ellie, is Florida, which everyone says you can't get off the Florida registry. That is not correct. You can petition for removal. I have petitioned successfully for removal in Florida. So if you are required to register in Florida, you can petition for removal. I believe the requirement is that you're on for at least 20 years, depending upon the offense. I've noted a couple times on the website, the Axel website, the attorney that I used, and there's recently an article on the Florida Action Committee website that also mentions his name. Great attorney, and if anyone can get you off the registry in Florida, he can. But if not, then you're there till you're dead and well after. They keep people on even after they've died. They keep them listed.
Right, so. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. So moving on from international travel is domestic travel, and every state is different. I have Googled travel restrictions for various states in this country, and it's different, and sometimes the information is outdated, and that's what you have to watch for to see how recent it is. I once had a call from somebody who traveled from California to Arkansas thinking that he and his family might move there, and he was stopped and identified as a registrant from California. And the fee to register in Arkansas was $400, which he didn't have. He returned to California without registering in Arkansas, and they put a warrant out for his arrest. So it turned out to be a mess. Hawaii is a very generous. I think if you have an aggregate stay of more than 30 days, you're required to register. And I know Janice has said, Washington, D.C., you don't have to register, but yesterday doing research, apparently if you stay more than 30 days a year, you're required to register. So like I said, every state is different. I've known people to travel to one state to take care of an elderly parent who didn't register. Nothing happened. I would recommend that because you never know when you're going to come in contact with law enforcement and what law enforcement will do. But domestic travel, you should check out the state and see what the restrictions are. Jan, you have your hand up? J-A-N-N, you there?
I'm here.
All right.
Let me see. Okay. Yeah, talking about any kind of travel and registration, I'd ask Janice this last Saturday whether there's a provision that you can get put online for deregistering or unregistering as you have in Hawaii. And she said she was not aware of any. I don't know if you are aware of any or not, but I just would suggest to anybody who's required to register, when you register wherever in another state or another country, ask them if they have a form or a process for unregistering or deregistering, however they would term it, so you can fill that out and submit it immediately. I found out inadvertently going to Hawaii a few years back that they do have a procedure that you can unregister in Hawaii, and they called to see where I was after I had registered, and I had them on my registration when I was leaving and flight and all that, which was a year ago, just a couple of years ago, and they don't automatically use the information you give them when you register and to take you off the registration. So just a suggestion, see if you can coerce the registering authority to give you the information on how to unregister even after you leave. You can usually do it online according to Hawaii laws anyway. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out.
It's a very good point, Jan, only because I know there's somebody who moved to Oregon for a minute and registered and informed the Oregon authorities that he was leaving the state entirely, and he's still showing up on the Oregon registry and trying to get any information out of Oregon in regard to his registration there has been awful. So that's a good point that you raise. Did you have another comment?
I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other comments in regard to domestic travel? All right. Moving on. Kel, and you know, a lot of the registrants here do in this meeting are from California, and all the attorneys on the Axel board can only practice in California. But the Department of Justice for California does have some information, additional laws. One is international travel. It says registrants who plan to travel outside outside of the U.S. should provide at least 21 days advance written notice of their travel plans to the local law enforcement agency having jurisdiction over their residence. The written notice should include dates of travel and travel destination. Forms are available at the local registering agency to document notice of intention to travel internationally. So that's something that California requires, providing at least 21 days notice to the agency where the individual registers. Here's another one. Registrants who are enrolled as students on a higher education, university, college, community college, or other institution of higher learning must register with a campus police department. So there is a law in regard to registering with campus police for anybody who's attending school in California. Another one is registrants who are on probation or parole must provide proof of registration to the probation or parole officer within 6 working days of release on probation or parole. And they also have to provide the annual update or any change in information to their probation or parole officer. A registrant whose victim was under 16 cannot work with children. It is a misdemeanor penalty for those who do. Registrants whose victim was 16 or older must notify the employer or volunteer organization before working with children. That's also a misdemeanor penalty. This is one that has created some controversy. Certain parole enrollees of certain convictions shall not be placed or reside during parole within a half a mile of any school, including any or all of kindergarten in grades 1 through 8. A registrant must not be on a school campus unless he or she has both a lawful purpose and written permission from the school's chief administrative officer. So that usually pertains to individuals who register and have a child who is in elementary or high school. Here's another one for California. A registrant who is on parole for any registrable offense may not, during parole, reside in any single-family dwelling with any other person also required to register unless those persons are legally related by blood, marriage, or adoption. Single-family dwelling does not include a residential facility which serves 6 or fewer persons. So that's very helpful because I know I was at a conference a year or so ago, and there is a woman in Long Beach, California, who provides group homes for registrants, and her maximum is 6 for each home that she has. Registrants must disclose their status as a registrant to a community care facility before they enter the facility. That's usually adult daycare homes for or rehab centers for the developmentally disabled individuals or adults. Registrants must disclose their status to a long-term health facility. So anybody who has to go into some type of a long-term health facility must notify in writing at least 45 days prior to their entry into the facility. This is one, GPS units for persons released on parole for life. So somebody who is a registrant and has lifetime parole has to wear a GPS tracking device. And the last one on this is registered offenders may not loiter near schools or elder-dependent adult facilities. So those are the laws that California has, and my guess that there may be other states with similar restrictions, but that's for California from the Department of Justice. David, you have a comment.
Yes, I wanted to mention, if you don't mind me going back for 1 second, to international travel.
Not at all.
Thanks. An important notification for anyone traveling internationally who is filling out the 21-day advanced travel notification form that you must complete, at least in California, and I suspect everywhere else. But there's a California form. You fill it out, and you submit it to your local registering agency, the police department, typically. One quick aside, please be aware that the folks at your local registering agency are not always knowledgeable professionals who know everything about the law. So if they say, oh, I'm unaware of that, then, you know, believe them. They're unaware of it. Okay. You need to do your own research, as we've all found out. Okay. So two important facts about the 21-day notification. I learned very quickly that that all you have to complete is noting the city or town or village name that you are staying in. You do not have to put a street address, a hotel name, nothing like that. So just put the name of the city and country that you're visiting. That's the first part. They never came back to me and asked me to give them greater detail. And you won't be bothered by the police anywhere you go in Europe. They're not going to come knocking at your door to make sure you're staying at, you know, Hotel Pelagio or wherever. Okay. But the second important thing that I would always do is at the very bottom, there's a space for additional comments, or, you know, just a small space to add additional information. I would always place there that I may also visit several other countries, and I would name them Italy, Portugal, Spain, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Austria, etc., etc., for a brief 1 or 2 day trip. I would always put that there just in case I wanted to venture off and travel somewhere else. If you put it there, you've covered yourself. You've informed them. They know that you may travel somewhere else. So when you get back to the state and they ask you, did you go anywhere else? You can say, I only visited places that I already told you I was visiting. That's all. Just wanted to let you know. You don't have to give them too much detail. And I wouldn't if I were you.
Thanks.
Yep.
All right. Christopher, welcome. You have a comment.
Yeah. If anybody's thinking about moving to Missouri, don't. If you're thinking about visiting Missouri, think twice. The way it works here, unlike all the other states, that even though the laws are on a state level, which is administered by the Highway Patrol farms it out to individual county to implement. And in doing that, the Highway Patrol allows the individual county to interpret and apply the law however they want. We have 114 counties, so you can have 114 different interpretations and applications of the exact same law. In Missouri, the requirement to register means that if you come from a different state and you enter the border of Missouri, stop at a rest stop and you take a nap, legally, by law, you are required to register and you are required to put the address of that rest stop as your home. Residence in Missouri is determined not by how long you have been in Missouri, but by where you sleep. And there is no definition of sleep. Doesn't matter if it's 1 minute or 5 hours. The law is incredibly vague. My opinion, unconstitutional. But that's how the law is applied. And I know that for my son, when I have called the sheriff's department for our county and questioned about going out of our city to go to another city within Missouri, I was told that I had to provide an address of where he would be sleeping. And if I couldn't, then he was not permitted to go. So unless I had a motel or a hotel or somebody that I knew, if I had their address, then he's not allowed to travel out of this county, which me is wrong, but, you know, that's the way it is. And that's if they're going to be gone overnight. It's not a case of you're going to go on vacation somewhere. If you're just gone overnight, then that's the way it is. Now, in our county, we have actually a very good person at the sheriff's department that deals with the registry. And there have been a few times where I have been admitted into the hospital and my son stays with me 24/7. She has not required him to have to register because it's a medical situation. He's with me at all times. So she kind of, you know, says, okay, he doesn't have to register the hospital as his address. But Missouri is pretty warped in our laws and the way that they're applied. So like I said, thinking about moving here, don't.
Well, Christopher, thank you for that information about Missouri. And although we were going to discuss pending litigation soon, we'll get to it now because there's pending litigation out of Missouri in regard to the Halloween sign challenge. And it started when one county, and I'm not sure which county in Missouri, but that county, the sheriff mandated that anybody on the registry in that particular county needed to post a sign on his or her front door saying, trick-or-treaters, don't come to this house, something in that regard. And Janice found somebody who was willing to challenge it, and she went to the trial court, and actually it was in district court. She filed in federal district court, and the judge found in her client's favor that it was compelled speech under the First Amendment Amendment. Most of us know it as the Freedom of Speech Amendment. But what happened in this case was it was government compelled speech that violated the First Amendment. Well, the Attorney General in that case appealed to the, I believe, the 11th Circuit. I might be mistaken. But there was a 3-judge panel who heard arguments and also agreed with Janice that the Halloween sign that people were required to post on their door violated the U.S. Constitution. Well, now the Attorney General for that state has appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they filed an appeal, and 16 other states have joined in an amicus. It doesn't mean that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear this case and take it on, but they filed a request. And so now Axol has now the task of fighting this appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And fortunately, there is a legal clinic at Northwestern Law School who has helped, who has accepted the challenge to help Janice. But it's one of the items that we're seeking funds for, because having a fight in the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take time and money. And I won't get into the details of that, but it's certainly going to be an important challenge. One thing that Janice found out after reading the brief sent to the U.S. Supreme Court by Missouri is that they're claiming that this is a issue in other states, which is not true. And so there's going to be, I think the brief that they filed with the U.S. Supreme Court was over 200 pages, pushing 300. So there's going to be a lot of work ahead for Axol and Janice. But this is going to be an important challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court. Hopefully they will deny cert, as the legal term is, and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeal decision will stand, saying that the Halloween signs are compelled speech, which violates the Constitution. Which brings me to another issue. And I don't know if there's anybody here from Florida, but in Florida, there's a case, Michael Crist versus the state of Florida. And Mr. Crist was found to be a sexual predator in Florida. And the state, because of that designation of being a sexual predator, state required that he gets a little emblem on his driver's license. His Florida driver's license was supposed to have an emblem. And what happened was, when he was stopped by the police, they looked at his driver's license and he had a little smile emoji blocking that designation as a sexual predator that Florida mandated. He filed a challenge to that in Florida. And right now, there is a petition for review in the Supreme Court of the United States, and they are going to review that appeal, that's the petition for cert, September 28th of 2026. So it's the same type of issue. The government having a designation on the driver's license as a sexual predator in Florida, it's compelled speech. And so far, that was the only other case I was able to find about compelled speech, but it was only pertained to sexual predators in Florida. I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if anybody from Florida is on this meeting from Florida, but that's kind of scary, because a lot of people see your driver's license. You know, you take it out for identification. It's not just something you hand to law enforcement. It's something that you give out to a lot of people. They need to check your ID. David, you're a former Floridian.
I am, for better or worse. I just had a quick question for you, Ellie, regarding that, since it is scheduled to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. So that won't in any way relate to the Missouri Halloween sign, even though they are both compelled speech by a registrant?
Interesting question. It's not going to be heard. They're going to look at it to see whether or not they're going to accept the case in September. Okay. And I actually, when I found this case, I had to do some digging. I'm going to send it to Janice only because I think it may have have some impact because the issue is compelled speech by the government. Even though it's in a different scenario, Missouri, it's the Halloween signs. Florida, it's the driver's license for those designated sexual predators. So there you go. But it's something, you know, I'd be concerned about. So I, who knows? Janice may already know about this. She's on top of everything. So Marina, is there something on the Florida Action Committee in regard to this case?
I don't know if it's that case we're talking about, but last night I received an email that the Action Committee had filed a suit against the registry and on its whole as it is different from the Smith v. Doe lawsuit from 2003. Had you read that?
No, but I will now. But okay. this is just in regard to the driver's license.
Well, that is being challenged in this new lawsuit as well.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. And Christopher, I hope you're wrong that the Supreme Court does not grant cert in the Missouri case. As Janice has said, the U.S. Supreme Court only grants cert in 1% of the cases that are sent to that particular court. And hopefully the Supreme Court will have its hands full with cases like whether or not the White House deserves a ballroom. But I digress, and I'm being a little facetious. So anyway, let's move on. So the other case that is going up to the Ninth Circuit is that case Doe versus the U.S. Department of Justice. Judge Bernal issued an injunction on one of the issues back in April 9th of this year, and both sides have filed appeals. The Pacific Legal Foundation has been representing the plaintiffs in that case, and the U.S. attorney, of course, represents the U.S. Department of Justice. So that case is going to be on our agenda for a while because the Ninth Circuit doesn't usually issue decisions quickly. So it'll probably be sometime next year. There was and this is just an example of how slow the Ninth Circuit can be. There was an appeal filed by someone who, when he was on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, he was accused of bribery. And the appeal was filed in November of 2023. And the Ninth Circuit just issued a per curiam decision a couple of weeks ago, affirming the conviction. So it was almost 3 years that it took the Ninth Circuit to issue that opinion. So there you go. So we're going to hear about John Doe versus the Department of Justice for a while. All right. Here is an update on some federal legislation. Let's see where my notes are. So there's a federal law pending that would prohibit registrants from receiving Medicaid. And also, there's a proposed federal law that would block registrants from entering federally funded shelters. I believe both of those laws were being proposed by Nancy Mace out of South Carolina. And she, I believe, was termed out or did not run for reelection. And I also heard that she was going to try to run for Lindsey Graham's seat, Senate seat, but she did not succeed well. So fortunately, she will go out of the public eye and those two bills will die. All right. So I'm going to start the next hour talking about the history of the registration law in California. I've been doing some research on the history. And California, I believe, was the first state to require people convicted of 11 offenses to register. And that was in 1947. It passed on June 20th of 1947, and it became effective 91 days after that date. Why 91 days? I don't know. What was interesting is that for any history buffs, Harry Truman was president of the United States in June of 1947, and Earl Warren was the governor of California at that time. That particular legislation was proposed, authored by two people in the assembly, Don Allen and Clifford Dills, kind of like trivia if you look at it. And the original registration law was geared to preventing gays from, you know, being part of society. And so it was like basically anti-gay legislation, even though it affected only 11 offenders. census at the time. There is a case that I came across from 1960, Abbott versus the City of Los Angeles. And this is another piece of trivia. Abbott versus the City of Los Angeles came about because Mr. Abbott was a conscientious objector and was imprisoned because of it. And then there was a law on the books about criminals having to register. And this was before 1947, before the registration law that we know of for registrants took effect. This law I think was before that. And he challenged that particular law, saying that it violated equal protection. And it was interesting because there's a blurb in that particular opinion that talked about the recidivism nature of certain crimes. And I don't know where they got their information, but it seemed to suggest that they thought that 290 registrants were more likely than not to recidivate and to commit more crime, which I find very appalling. And so back in 1960, the California Supreme Court was still issuing opinions based upon incorrect information. But I am going to do a little more deeper dive into the history of registration and maybe the next meeting that I get to host, I will bore you with that information as well. Let's go on. Does anybody have any questions, though, about the registration law? I haven't been able to look in the chat. So some people have said that the federal motion in regard to Medicaid was proposed by a representative out of Florida. Good old Florida. Okay. So let's go on to the tiered registry in California.
Ellie, Dave has a question.
Oh, there's a question, David.
Thanks, Roger. Ellie, I just had a quick comment since you were going to do some research on registration requirements. Apparently, the Smith v. Doe case that was the start of all this at the federal level, which Supreme Court Justice, I guess, the current one, Roberts, he was the Alaska Attorney General at the time. And yes. Apparently, in their argument, they used some very, very false information regarding recidivism based on a Psychology Today article and the opinion of someone in Psychology Today saying that there was a frightening and high rate of recidivism. So just be aware that there's that crazy history all the way back then saying that it was frightening and high for registrant recidivism.
Well, in Abbott versus the City of LA, I couldn't even find in the opinion any reference to why they jumped to the conclusion that registrants are more likely to recidivate. That's interesting. And just to remind everybody about Smith versus Doe, that was the case that the U.S. Supreme Court said registration is not punishment. It's not punitive. It is just a civil remedy to keep track of registrants for law enforcement. I believe the Psychology Today article might be in the briefing that the defendants made. And so hopefully we can find that article and post it on the Axol website. But it's really amazing, you know, to be in the legal profession and to read opinions that are based on nonsense, not scientific. So that's what we have to put up with at times. But more on that later. But thank you, David, for that. Any other comments? Did somebody have a hand up? All right. So let's talk about the California Registry. The proposed change in the law happened in 2019, but it didn't take effect until 2021. And it went from lifetime registration to tiered registration. And so in California, there is tier one, tier two, and tier three. Tier one, if somebody falls into tier one, the registration requirement is 10 years. If somebody is on tier two, the registration requirement is 20 years. And tier three, the registration requirement is lifetime and remains at lifetime. So the last time I checked, there were over 100,000 people in the California registry. I don't have a breakdown on how many in tier one, tier two, or tier three, but there are a number of people eligible to terminate their registration in California, and they're simply not going forward with the process. I was at a meeting with the that was held by the California Sex Offender Management Board in March, and they were assuming that maybe tier one people aren't on Megan's list, so they don't get on that map of people who have to register, or else they're too lazy that they have just kind of flown under the radar. And but people in tier one or tier two, you need the requisite time, and if you have met the requirement, you need to terminate your registration. There are a few reasons why the 10-year period or the 20-year period is extended. Subsequent incarceration can also extend the time period, and also if somebody picks up a failure to register. Failure to register as a misdemeanor adds 1 year to the time period, and failure to register as a felony adds three. So so there are always exceptions. JP, you have your hand up.
I just find from my experience of talking to people in my community and talking to the sheriff's department here that handles registration, that most of the people on level one do not get the information because they are not on high priority. And in my community, ACSOL is not advertised or offered because the law enforcement in the community wants to keep the people on the registry and punish them as much as possible, even when they're not doing anything wrong anymore. I'm 20 years experience at this now. And that's what I see, is that they just don't know the law change. They don't know that they can petition to get off.
JP, are you in California?
I'm in Arizona. I get punished a lot more. I'm almost as bad as some of the other things I hear from Missouri and Florida, although I do know that I've heard worse from Florida, but all of that's anecdotes. I just know that I was lucky enough to be like 3 months before it became a punishment for the rest of your life, but the community is forcing the rest of your life punishment, even though I don't have anything in the courts anymore.
Okay, thank you. You raise a good issue about in regard to how Axol and other providers can reach out to people, especially those in more rural counties in California, to let them know that, you know, if they meet the requirements, the time period, that they can terminate. That's something that I've always tried to, you know, work towards, letting people know, you know, when they can terminate and how they can terminate. I noticed something in the chat about wobblers. And I think, Rick, you might have posted something in the chat about wobblers. In California, a wobbler is a crime which could be charged as a misdemeanor or a felony. It's totally up to the discretion of the prosecutor whether to file as a misdemeanor or a felony. And sometimes the prosecutor will look at the person's criminal history, and if there's a significant criminal history, this district attorney or prosecutor will file as a felony. If somebody in California is convicted of a wobbler and they go to state prison, it will remain a felony. But if the individual gets a probationary sentence and completes probation, the crime can be reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor. And that also could affect somebody's ability to go from tier three to tier one. Let me give you an example. There is a case of People versus Manzor. And Manzor, I believe, was convicted of a 288.2 of the penal code. And he had his felony conviction reduced to a misdemeanor. And as a felony conviction, he was in tier three. Now, a 288.2 as a felony requires tier three lifetime registration. But as a misdemeanor, there is no registration requirement. And so Mr. Manzor went to try to get off the registry, and the trial court said no, and the appellate court said no, because he went from a crime where there was was registration to something where there was no registration. And the Court of Appeal filed an opinion and said, you're out of luck. You have to remain in Tier 3. So even though his conviction went from a felony to a misdemeanor, he is now still lifetime registration. However, there is a case pending in the Court of Appeal now. And for those of you who know Chance Oberstein, he was the attorney on the appeal, and his client was convicted of a certain offense. And as he was convicted of a felony, and it was reduced to a misdemeanor that still required registration. That was the difference between that case and Manzor. This case is called Trot Castro. That's his last name. And the trial court said, I'm not terminating your registration. You're still in Tier 3. And that court was relying on the People versus Manzor case. Well, Mr. Oberstein filed an appeal, and the attorney general agreed with him that since his client went from Tier 3 to Tier 1, he's eligible for a petition to terminate because he's now in Tier 1. And that case, the appellate court has not issued an opinion, but the attorney general agreed with him. So that is hope for people in California who have a wobbler who got probation. And if the reduction to a misdemeanor still requires registration and goes into Tier 1, then that person can go from lifetime registration to 10-year registration. So we keep waiting to see when the appellate court will issue the opinion. And as of Thursday, when we had our Axel board meeting, the opinion had not been issued. But knowing that the attorney general agrees with Mr. Oberstein and his position, it gives us some hope of people changing from Tier 3 into Tier 1. Any questions about that? And I know this, we have a lot of people from other states, and unfortunately, every state is different in regard to terminating registration. So this is purely in regard to California. I know that in California, there is a procedure to expunge a record, and expunging a record does not mean that registration terminate. The expungement process is completely different from a petition to terminate registration. And also the certificate of rehabilitation, that does not have anything to do with terminating registration. Anyway, any questions on that? Okay. Norm, I like what you say. We all have to become pro se attorneys of sorts. Unfortunately, that may be true with all of the changes. And also, Roger, thank you for posting the Psychology Today article. I believe the author of that article regrets it being used in the Smith versus Doe case, if I'm correct. Okay. So do we have any other topics that anybody would like to bring up? Anybody have any comments? Okay. Let me see what other notes I have.
Michael has a comment. First Joe, and then Michael.
Hello, I'm Michael. I live in Minnesota. I've said this before, but I think it bears saying again. Every state is so different. I'm still on paper for another 20 months. I often take the train across the country to Washington State to visit my son and my eldest daughter in their communities of Seattle and the Mettow Valley in the town of Twisp. There's just no trouble at all, train travel, including no TSA. A delightful way to travel, and I can stay in Washington State, as far as I am aware, for 10 days without triggering a requirement to register. Being a resident of Minnesota means that, and even on still on parole, I can travel throughout the state of Minnesota. Minnesota would not have required me to wear a tracking device, but California on the Interstate Compact, because I'm out of California, does require me to tracking device. So what Minnesota has done for me is say, okay, you can wear a tracking device, but it's this tracking device. It's a little wristwatch, and it is my GPS tracker. And the reason that I was able to get that was after suffering a cardiac arrest in March, I have to wear certain things on my leg, and my cardiologist just made it clear to California that it's either this stuff or your ankle monitor, and if he dies, you will probably be sued for a great deal of money. And California said, oh, okay, fine, we're good with the wrist tracker then. In Minnesota, there are no residency requirements in the state of Minnesota. I live wherever I want. I own a home home in Winona. No travel restrictions. It is, I check in with an agent once every 3 months, and to register every year, they send something in the mail and I fill it out and I mail it back. So I just want to give a plug for certain states that are, for the most part, very humane. The one thing about Minnesota that is not humane is that if you ever get civilly committed, you're in real, real trouble. But other than that, it's a marvelous place. It does get a tiny bit chilly in the winter, and I will shut up now. Thanks for letting me.
Thank you, Michael. That's good to know. We like Minnesota because it is a blue state. I like blue states. Joe, you have your hand up.
Thanks, Ellie. I just want to repeat what I put in the chat. One of the reasons we don't have people that are aware of the change of the law that can get off the registry by submitting a petition is it's difficult to notify them. With the high cost of postage now, it's so much to send letters. This is just a crass comment that we need money. Every organization need money, file the lawsuit, to send the letters, to do the research, to do everything that we are doing to help protect registrants. So if you can donate to Axol, please do. If you can donate in your state for those particular agencies, please do to help the fight going.
Thank you. David.
Hey, Ellie. Hey, Joe. Thank you for that comment. I definitely encourage everyone also, please donate whatever you can, whatever is comfortable for you. It's really important. We've got these lawsuits going. Axol's got lawsuits everywhere all the time, and we really do need the funding. So please, if you are able to donate, please do that. Just a quick comment on what Joe had said, and that is that we, I just completely lost my track of what I was going to say, but Joe's comment is important that you please donate if you can.
Thanks, David.
Yep.
Cristobal.
Thank you, everyone. The reason I decided to join this organization, which we are extremely grateful, we have a son who he's in jail right now. He'll be released, I believe, 2029 or 2030. And all the information that I am getting from all of you is really, really helping us. Now, he has been doing his own research, and he told us, you know, when I get out, he said, you guys have to buy a house because, he said, if they don't find a place for me to live, they will put me back in jail. I wanted to know if that is true because I know that as I hear all the different input, each state is different. And one day I asked Gianni, I said, which is the best state to live? Because he used to live in Portland, Oregon. And I asked her, is it easier for him to live in Portland, Oregon? Or is it easier for him to come and live in California? Gianni said, California will be much better for him. So I would like some input on that. And that's why I will be sending an email to Ellie to get more familiarized with the whole process because it is very challenging. And my wife is very concerned that what is going to happen to him because I can see the pain. And when I went to the in-person meeting, you felt the pain of all the people that are there. And we know that he's going to be facing an uphill battle. But I would like your input. Thank you very much.
You know, Cristobal, one thing I think is that family support is always a factor to consider. And if you're in California, he may want to be with you and his family. If he's in a California prison, he's going to be out on parole, and getting parole transferred from one state to another is doable, but it's a process. And if he gets out in California, the first thing he has to do is register. And therefore, if he moves to like another state, he'll have to register there, and then he'd have to register and, you know, be have a second registry. And I think it just goes back to, you know, family support is probably something he needs to consider. David, did you want to comment?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry. I remember my comment regarding what Joe S. had just brought up, and that is regarding the response rate, or I should say contacting people on the registry regarding their ability to unregister, to be removed, to petition for removal in California. I have worked with Janice on it's either two or three occasions and sent out 100 mailers each time to individuals close to where our in-person meetings would be, in my case, in Pasadena. So we sent out 100 envelopes with letters inside indicating that this meeting is occurring on this date. There's information about you getting off of the registry. And unfortunately, every time we send out those mailers, yes, it costs us money. I've done those on my own dime each time because I want to get people involved and let them know what's happening. The sad part is the response rate is about 3, if we're lucky, 4%. Send out 100 letters, you know, at a significant cost, and only 3 or 4 people bother to show up at meeting. To me, it's a little bit insane. Here you have an organization offering to help you get off the registry, and people don't bother showing up. You know, and there's no, it states there's no fee to them or no cost. Just show up and get the information, and they don't bother to show up. But to me, it's a bit crazy. So yes, we can blame the law enforcement agencies, the registering agencies, for not informing people. But at the same time, people are not advocating for themselves. It's, to me, it's extremely frustrating. I don't understand why people wouldn't get involved if they can get themselves off of the registry. That's my comment.
And also to add that there are public defender offices in each county, and the public defender would be able to assist somebody in filing a petition to terminate if that individual does not have the money to pay for a lawyer. Plus, you know, when I was directing my clinic, I help, you know, file petitions for people on a pro bono basis to get off the registry. And I don't know of many legal clinics in Los Angeles County that continue to do that. But, you know, it's service that I think some nonprofits or the public defender will do it for free. And so there are those resources. I know that sometimes public defenders get a bad rap. And, you know, being a former public defender, I've been told I'm the public pretender or the dump truck, but, you know, they do good work. And so anyway, cost should not be something to prohibit somebody from registering. Michael, you have your hand up again.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one more thing about my state, Minnesota. We have an interesting thing here. I came across from California on the interstate compact. I don't even appear in California anymore. I don't exist there, apparently. I'm off Megan's. I'm off everything. But in this state, I came across as a level 2, and I'm still a level 2. But Minnesota has an interesting thing. After you've been here a certain amount of time, you can petition to have your registration tier lowered. So I am going to apply to a committee to lower my status from tier 2 to tier 1. And there's a reasonable chance that I can actually accomplish that state. If the answer is no, I can reapply every 12 months. So that could be a 10-year gift in terms of the length of registration. So I don't know if other states have that or not, but I thought I'd mention it here. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. And I have a question. If you're in tier 2, do you have a way to terminate registration?
At the end of the time, yes.
Okay. And so if you are lowered to tier 1, you could probably terminate then?
At the end of 10 years.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
JP.
So my public defender told me in meeting in the jail that he could easily get one of my charges dropped, but that he would advise that it would probably be a 2-year fight to take my other charge to trial, which sounded very promising. But when he talked to my family members about gathering evidence because I was in jail, he told my family member that the only reason he was on the case was because it was assigned to him, and if he didn't take it, he would be fired, and that he did not want a sex offender case on his docket at all because it looks bad when he tries to get promotions or when he tries to become a judge. Because if as a public defender, he wins the case, he looks like he's advocating on behalf of sex offenders and helping them. And thus, he would never have the career opportunity to become a judge or to better his life.
Well, God help us if he does become a judge, because it sounds like somebody that I would not want to practice in front of. That was a really horrible thing for him to say.
Yeah. The sad part is I didn't find out about it until about 6 months later. Of course, I had already taken a plea bargain at the time, but had I found out about it, it was grounds to have him removed from my case, which I think is what he was hoping for, because yes, he may have become a good lawyer. My interaction with him as his client seemed to be professional, but in the large scheme of things, a lot of people in my, a lot of the lawyers in my area and a lot of the people within the court system and within the politician system in my area will not touch anything that says sex offender with a 10-foot pole unless they have to. And if they have to, it's automatically the maximum thing they can do to punish the person. Like Governor Ducey having to sign the law that moved dangerous crimes against children from being level one no report to being level one reporting, because if he didn't sign that budget bill, because the budget was completely off the wall, he would have immediately lost his prospect for reelection because he wasn't hard against sex offenders. And that was a budget bill.
Thanks for sharing that.
Ellie?
Yeah.
Could I speak up for just a second?
Sure.
That is one of the things that Axol is fighting for. Both Janice and Catherine Carpenter have been very proactive in classes at law school, especially the Southern, and I'm probably saying the Southwestern Law School, if that's the right name, Ellie. But yes, they have held seminars for law students and also continuing education classes that lawyers attend to keep themselves current, advising them of all the problems that the sex offender registry present, and certainly advising them against taking plea deals for anyone not to plead no contest and those type things, but mainly to give young lawyers that are starting out information that they're not taught in regular law class so they can better prepared to represent first charge with these type of crimes.
Yes, that's one of the important functions of Axol, and thanks to Axol and the Axol and then the Family Safety Foundation of giving the impetus for Janice to do these continuing legal education classes for lawyers. There was one, I believe, last fall through Southwestern, as Joe said, and it was a success. Not everybody gets trained not every lawyer gets trained in law school to deal with these issues. And one of my pet peeves is the individuals in California who get convicted of an offense and then have maybe a 10-year or a 20-year parole. And when they come out of prison, they are shocked to hear that they are going to have a 20-year parole because of their offense. And they were never advised. I've had people say, the judge just told me I'm going to prison. I'll be out on parole for a period of up to 3 years. And lo and behold, it's a 10-year period. And that's a really harsh consequence in California for certain offenses to have either a 10-year parole or a 20-year parole, with very little leeway to have that term terminated before the period expired. So good point in regard to trying to educate practicing lawyers. Someone who's identified as me, you have your hand up. Me.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Just a quick thing. I didn't quite catch everything about the getting off the registry. I went from terminating my probation, and then Mr. Overstein got me to go from felony to misdemeanor. But then there was something about maybe going back being a tier three or something like that, or did I misunderstood? Can I apply, I think next year would be the year that after next year I could apply for my removal.
So you had a wobbler offense filed initially as a felony?
Yes.
And then your felony was reduced to a misdemeanor?
Yes, Mr. Overstein did that.
Yes. And so did you get a new tier assignment?
Yes, I'm in one.
Tier one. So once you have the 10-year registration requirement, I would say file a petition to get removed.
Okay. So there's nothing else for me to do but to do that. And then do I do the expungement afterward?
Certain offenses, certain registrable offenses aren't eligible for an expungement. So without knowing what you were convicted of, I couldn't tell you if it's qualified for an expungement.
Looking at things on the internet.
Yeah, the expungement statute specifically excludes certain registrable offenses. And off the top of my head, I don't know them. I always have to look at the statute. So you can file for an expungement as long as you're not on probation or any type of supervision and you don't have a pending criminal matter. So if you qualify, if you're not not on probation, you can see if your offense qualifies for an expungement.
Okay.
And then you file it where you were in the county where you were convicted, or if your probation was, say, transferred from one county to another, you file where the in the county where the probation was transferred to.
Okay, it's all been on the at the county of LA.
Okay, then you can file in LA County at the courthouse where you got the conviction for the expungement.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. And as I said, it's as long as it qualifies for expungement, because like I said, there's a handful of registrable offenses that are ineligible for the expungement.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So one thing that I want to talk about, because I don't think we talk about this very much, is registration for minors. And when I was preparing for this meeting yesterday, I found an article, and now it's 6 years old, but it starts off with over 200,000 individuals are on registries for offenses committed when they were children. This is somewhat appalling that children from certain offenses have to register. And this is another shocking one. Children on the registry, including some as young as 8 years old, face residency and employment restrictions, as well as barriers to education, suffer the stigmatization of being labeled an offender, and can face possible incarceration failing to meet onerous registration and reporting requirements. A 2013 Human Rights Watch report examined the grave consequences befalling registered youth. Over 85% of these youth reported serious mental health issues or suicidal ideation. One other thing, it says 39 states require youth to register as sex offenders. 31 states require registration for statutorily enumerated offenses, and two of those states require youth registration exclusively for adjudications of rape. Six states do not specifically list offenses, but instead provide that registration is required for all sex offenses. So it seems that, you know, minors who have to register have the burdens the same as adults, but maybe a little more, because, you know, research tends to suggest that a person's mind isn't developed until they reach the age of 26. And for somebody who's as young as 12, 13, 14 years old who has to register, it's certainly a burden on them. But I just wanted to kind of plant the seed. If anybody knows any individuals who were juvenile offenders, I